Well, you gotta turn this. It's. All right, we had a little bit of feedback there, so I need to have the second computer taken out of the room. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the North Dakota Medical Association's Wednesday webinar and open forum discussion. I'm Courtney Kobel, the Executive Director of NDMA, and on behalf of NDMA, I want to thank everybody here for attending the webinar and for your membership commitment to NDMA. Just a reminder, this webinar is being recorded. We are back after a month's hiatus. We are going to be doing these webinars every other week from here on out. So next webinar will be August 19th. On August 19th, we're going to be having Dr. Carl Vidal. Dr. Vidal, he completed his family medicine residency here in North Dakota, and he's also a COVID-19 survivor. What makes him unique is that he was not expected to live, and he was in the hospital for 55 days. He's believed to be among the nation's most critically ill COVID-19 patients to make such an incredible recovery. So we'll hear his story in 2 weeks. From my end, in COVID news this week, the North Dakota Emergency Commission approved nearly $320 million in the third round of COVID-19 relief. This is $320 million for North Dakota. Our total package was $1.2 billion. In this $320 million, it was $59 million for cities and counties, $97 million for health programs, and $100 million to keep unemployment insurance trust fund solvent. And then also last week, NDMA joined with the Hospital Association, the Nurses Association, and the Long-Term Care Association in a joint letter to the editor urging the public to take simple steps that we know will help stop the spread of the virus. Wearing a face mask, maintaining physical distancing, and washing hands. The theme of the letter was masks work. I want to make my news short, so I'm gonna go right into tonight's webinar panelists. Of course, we have Joan Connell. She is the North Dakota Department of Health Field Officer, and she leads the North Dakota Department of Health Physician Advisory Group. And she, of course, will give us an update from that and an update from the Department of Health. And then we welcome back Dr. Paul Carson. He's an infectious disease expert from the NDSU Department of Public Health, and he's also a professor at UND School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and he also works at Sanford Health. He is the director of the NDSU Center for Immunization Research and Education. After the presentations, we'll have an opportunity for open discussion. Please type your question in the question box or raise your hand. And if necessary, you'll be unmuted to present your question or discussion topic. Please keep yourselves muted for obvious reasons until you are talking. So I will hand it over to Joan then. And thank you again for both of you for being here tonight.
Thank you so much for continuing to have me, Courtney. I really appreciate it. All right, I feel like so much has happened since we last met. And I remember the biggest thing that happened over the 4th of July weekend was the fact that the notification system went down for providing patients their negative results. And so your few volunteers from your Department of Health called, I think, over several hundred people to provide them with their results. And that sort of leads to the struggle with getting results out to patients as quickly as we would like to do that. So we are continuing to strategize with IT systems and other routes of informing patients of their negative results. The lab has been running fairly smoothly. I mean, you can expect that there's going to be equipment issues that come and go, and that has continued to be the case, but I don't think there's anything that's been catastrophic. And most days, the turnaround time for it, running the test and getting a result from the point it hits the lab is 22 to 24 hours. So I think that's pretty remarkable. And I'm feeling fortunate that we're at that turnaround time because we have to increase by another several thousand tests soon. In particularly, we're going to try to accommodate all of the incoming college kids the week of August 17th. So that will be particularly challenging. It sort of seems like talking to some of the healthcare facilities, this is starting to sort out where the healthcare facility does diagnostics of symptomatic patients and perhaps those who have been truly defined as a close contact. And the static test sites or local public health or other entities like that are where you would go if you're just curious if you might have COVID and want to get a test. So there's nothing hard and fast about that, but that does seem to be how healthcare facilities are starting to designate themselves as far as testing goes. The other thing I want to bring up about testing, because it probably involves several of our members. There are some healthcare facilities who have decided not to consider COVID results as a critical value. Therefore, they do not check for the results and they don't call patients back with the results. And this can be, we had one patient call the hotline in tears because she found out from looking at her portal that her test was positive and she didn't know where to go or what to do. It was very upsetting for her. We have several patients who need to know their test results because they're getting on an airplane, because they need to have a surgery. And they're not getting test results. So I think Tim Weidrich will be working through the North Dakota Hospital Association to make try and come to an agreement that people need test results in a timely manner and develop a process that works for everyone. Obviously, a huge thing going on in the Department of Health now, both state and local, is the K-12 and the university restart programs. So as you know, with the K-12 restart, it has been left up to each district to develop their school plan with consultation and advice, not approval, from their local public health units. And this is an additional responsibility for local public health, along with the testing, increased testing, contact tracing that they've been asked to do. So this is a little bit burdensome. Courtney talked about increased funds going to local public health, but it is really hard to find, at least on the state level, appropriately trained and people who can do these types of jobs. So I'm concerned about, you know, we can have all kinds of money in the world, but if we don't have the right kind of people to fill the position, it's not going to be helpful. So we might have to look at some more unique, innovative solutions for those sorts of issues. When Courtney talked about the letter regarding masks, the physician advisory group took a strong position on masks. And Dr. Winston asked that we take a vote and made a motion to make a recommendation to Governor Burgum that we mandate mask use in public areas. And that was unanimously voted and agreed upon. So we did send that recommendation to the governor on behalf of the physician advisory group. We've also been strategizing some social media campaigns. So again, if you know anyone 20 to 40 years old, Carl is over 40, I asked, but I still think he'd make a great story because he's got young kids, who is a COVID survivor of any sort and would like to share their story, especially including social media. We being the Department of Health, would be very interested in that. And then finally, one last, two last things to talk about. Since we last met, the homeless population management has gone from being a state function to a local public health function. Another thing on local public health and local human service zone centers' responsibilities. So the Bismarck Burley is having a lot of difficulty finding appropriate housing for this very vulnerable population. So if anyone's interested in participating in this group who tries to find some answers, that's great. But that continues to be a problem, particularly in the Bismarck area. And then finally, as far as treatments go, I can't remember if we talked about dexamethasone late in June. So I think that has come about, and what a nice, available, easy treatment for patients who have supplemental oxygen requirement. The other thing that happened, though, was remdesivir, which was being allocated to us for free. The allocation process and the distribution process changed. So now hospitals knew they still receive their allocation number from the state, but then the hospitals need to purchase it from their pharmacy purchasing site, and then it will be shipped. So that's a little bit different. We also last week changed the criteria. So if you meet NIH guidelines, which basically you're hospitalized and have oxygen sats less than 94% are the major ones, then you are eligible for treatment. So those were the major issues in the last several weeks. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them at this time.
Joan, do you want to thank you very much for that update. I know it seems like forever since we had our last webinar. Do you want to update a little bit more about the schools? Is I know that public health has to be working with those schools. Do you know if our schools reaching out to public health, or are they just really kind of going on their own?
I've been participating with the group of local public health administrators, and it seems like everyone is involved. I think the concern from my perspective is you know, I don't know if anybody read the Bismarck Tribune, but the Mandan superintendent said, this is not the plan I would have chosen, but this is the plan that everyone could live with. You know, so this is about so much more than public health right now, or about what's best for the kid. I think that it becomes very difficult to... I find it very difficult to work in an environment like that because... we're in a public health crisis now, so it's hard for me to understand why the major focus isn't about public health.
What was the difference? Do you know that what he wanted and what he could live with?
You know, I don't know. And I kind of looked at that. Dr. Field probably knows, and I don't know if he's on the call. But I feel looking through the Bismarck Tribune and reading his plan, I mean, what I noticed was there was some attention to trying to respect that 6-foot distancing. Mm-hmm. But mask use isn't going to be throughout the day. And the bus doesn't sound like it's going to be 6 feet apart. So, you know, by the time the kids get to school, if they are wearing their masks. I think you have to wear, I can't remember for sure, but I think you have to wear a mask if social distancing is impossible. So maybe in the hallways and stuff. For the Morton County policy, you certainly have to do that for Bismarck Burley. But so, you know, I'm a little concerned with some of these plans. They all take pieces of all of the cool recommendations, but I have to see a plan that implements all of that right now.
Great. You better tell Mike he's got to hop on a webinar because I think he signed up.
Stop. He's going to try.
Okay, I'm just kidding. Dr. Kumar had a question or had a comment.
Do we have a cutoff number at where they would consider closing down the schools if the positivity rate or infection rate in the community? The reason I'm asking is that one of the persons who was doing this said there are no guidelines and they're making it up as they go. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar. And yeah, no, and I got to sit in on a webinar that the CDC held about school reopenings. I filled in for Tim Weidrich, and the CDC doesn't have guidelines yet. And so I want you to feel good about that, because sometimes I feel like the CDC is being accused of kowtowing to somebody, but they're waiting for the science to back up a recommendation like that, and it just isn't there yet. So no, there's no hard and fast number. You bring up a great point though. Another big challenge with this is, you know, when you look at the K-12 restart, the zone, what color zone are we in? We're in green, and the state is all in green. We're not supposed to break that up by county or district. But the plans are supposed to be local. So, but people look at those zones then and think they have to write a plan that correlates with what the zone theoretically should be. And so, for example, in Burley-Morton now, we're really not green, you know, if you look at the infection rate. Yet if you read our blue-green guidance, you know, it's a lot more lax. And so the plan is more lax than it could be. And so that's the problem. So after like a week of looking at these plans, and I'm sorry it took that long, but I finally yesterday at the local public health call, I said, stop tying your plan to the zone, to the color zone, because that's going to mess up how to respond to what's happening in your communities. You have to tie it to something else, and maybe you can't give it a specific number. Maybe you just have to say if cases are increasing, and then you have to make that decision at the time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kumar. Thanks, Joan. Anybody else? All right. Oh, Misty raised her hand.
Sorry, I didn't get my clicker on there. My question is about returning to sports for the fall. You know, you mentioned about returning to school, but do you have any thoughts on that? I see they're having a state baseball tournament right now, right up the street from me. But I know Minnesota has pushed back already to the spring their football season, and I didn't know if Joan had any thoughts about any discussion going on for fall sports in North Dakota.
Yeah. Well, so Kirby was a part of the North Dakota High School Activities Association team when they were making their plan to that they eventually published, which focused a lot on the referees' whistles and and a few other things, but basically did not use the phased approach to return to play that had been suggested by the CDC, and I'm sure suggested by Kirby. After that was released, I think within the last day or two, Kirby and the rest of the infectious disease group has released a North Dakota Department of Health sports guidance. So I think I'm concerned that that's going to be one of our biggest risks for transmission of infection. And I think the other thing that goes with that, Misty, is during that whole time, it was like the third to fourth week in July, the CDC came out a week and a half later than they had promised with their back to school guidance. And they changed, or they have, you know, what do you do with a person, kid, or teacher or staff with symptoms? And there's one of the columns where if you have symptoms, you can simply go home and return when your fever's been gone for 24 hours and your symptoms are improving. So that opens up this whole box of kids who and adults in the school system who might not ever get tested, which means it's going to be impossible to do any contact tracing. And if they're returning to school, and I'm really curious to see what Dr. Carson has to say about this. If they're returning to school 24 hours after resolution of fever, I know that is based on the viral load is significantly decreased with other viruses now. Can we feel comfortable with that in SARS-CoV-2, or do we not know yet?
All right, you hold that. Oh, here he is.
Why don't we hold that? I'm going to go over a little bit of the science on some of the stuff with kids and just for a few thoughts on that. And maybe we can address that at that time.
Okay. Dr. Kumar, did you have one more question?
Nope, that was it. Thank you.
Oh, all right. All right, Dr. Carson. Thanks a lot, Joan. And I really appreciate the update. And then I'll just hand it over to Dr. Carson then.
All right, thanks, Courtney, and thank you, Joan, for that update. Good evening, everyone. I don't have anything particularly sort of systematic to talk about, so I'm just going to give you sort of the things that have been on my mind or bothering me, more of interest to me lately. And so, am I able to share here, Courtney? It looks like I can. So just a few things, just very briefly on the update on the epidemiology and what we're kind of seeing. And is my screen shared? Can you give me a thumbs up if you're seeing that? Okay, great. So this is a website, one of many that collects data from across the country. Here, this is Florida. I don't want Florida on there. I want the whole U.S. They have the daily tests, daily positives, current hospitalized, and daily deaths. And as you all are, I think, aware, we were really seeing a spike in cases in the U.S., which was predominantly in the Sun Belt, but scattered kind of everywhere. We're seeing it here in North Dakota as well, but Sun Belt states really drove the majority of this surge, but you can kind of see the hint of the trend that it is coming down again, which is hopeful and thankful for that, and that's probably in the wake of several of the Sun Belt states implementing a lot stricter measures. Not unexpectedly, hospitalizations have surged with that. That's a relatively short trailing indicator. Most people who get sick enough to be hospitalized do so kind of at the end of the first week, beginning of the second week. Deaths are a trailing indicator anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks out. And we see deaths going up, and I suspect we're going to see that curve of deaths go up for the next at least couple of weeks. If you look at what's kind of happening in North Dakota, this is a dashboard we built for our Red River Valley Task Force. But one of the graphs I like on here the most is the 14-day rolling average of new cases in the state and in Cass County, where I met. And so this is the 14-day rolling average daily new cases. Red is Cass County, dark gray is the rest of the state. And you can kind of see, we're really surging here in the state. Passing our earlier peak in end of May and into June, and really kind of peaking again now. For once, the spotlight isn't on, my town, Fargo and Cass County. It's more out west, and particularly, I think, Burley and Morton counties, which is making up a lot of this increase. The other graph that I think is somewhat useful to show, and this is more for the tabular data here, is you know, how much that is long-term care. So this is just, you know, what we had in Fargo. So in Cass County, our cases, this is number of active cases in Cass County, and the breakdown of how many of those were in long-term care, which is the red, and how many were not in long-term care. And you can see a big portion of our cases earlier on were in long-term care, and we've had a lot of aggressive efforts at serial testing to bring that down. If you look now at the rest of North Dakota in the tabular data here, you can see we've got outside of Cass County, 24 active residents, 53 active positive staff. And you know, this is a problem for us and something we really need to focus on. And something I actually have a grad student that's kind of looking at this almost as a research question, because I'll show you some data in a second here that suggests masking for source control really seems to work in a lot of settings, but it isn't seeming to work in some of our nursing home settings. And I think some of that is really because of how adherent staff are to really being judicious and consistent with the use of those masks and face shields and hand hygiene and foaming in and foaming out. And we're getting some data on that, and we hope to get some more. But if you are a nursing home director, if you're working closely with nursing homes, I really encourage you to have your nurse managers, directors of nursing, get out on the floor and kind of track people and see how well they're doing. Is their mask sitting around their chin all the time? Is their face shield flipped up? Are they really foaming in and foaming out? Because in other settings, the masking for source control seems to work. I'll kind of go over a little bit other data here that I have or things that are sort of interesting me lately. So if you're like me and you're in healthcare and you got kind of crazy family members and, you know, crazy friends, they're sending you every sort of YouTube video that's out there on the internet with the latest contention of like how you public health people are trying to fool us, or the medical community doesn't know what they're talking about. The latest one I got, and I'm betting a number of you did too, was the America's Frontline Doctors video. And I just want to go through a few of what they contend. First of all, just who are the America's Frontline Doctors? I mean, this is a woman who practices mostly law now and a little bit of concierge medicine. She, two ophthalmologists, an orthopedic surgeon, a pain doctor, family medicine doctor who got very notorious for some of her beliefs about that we're injecting alien DNA in our vaccines and that gynecologic problems are from, you know, dreams where you have sex with demons. I mean, so this is not, the A-team for public health or infectious diseases. Nevertheless, that didn't stop them from appearing on the Supreme Court steps, putting out a number of videos. And so one of the things they contended was masking doesn't work. And I think one of the things we have to own up to is that a lot of us were saying that at the very beginning of this. I said it, and what we meant by that, and now I'm much more careful about saying, here's the limits of what we know. Here's what we know thus far. So we were basing that information, one, on the need to preserve PPE for healthcare workers, and two, because most of the data that we had was based on influenza and the ability of masks to protect individuals from getting influenza. There was precious little data on using masks as a means of source control, which is really what we're talking about for masking with SARS-CoV-2. And I actually think SARS-CoV-2 might be moderately different than influenza. I think influenza may, you know, we know it's spread by droplets and maybe a short ballistic aerosol, but I think influenza also has a pretty good amount of spread through fomites. And I don't think fomite is as big a deal with SARS-CoV-2. And so masks might work better for SARS-CoV-2 than it does for influenza. But I want to share a little bit of data with you that is not randomized controlled trials, but it's compelling cases or anecdotes. So first, there's a number of engineers who have done a variety of studies looking at sort of engineering aspects of this. And one of them was from the University of Florida Atlantic, where they kind of had this mannequin that they designed to simulate a typical cough. And they were able to show that without anything on this cough, that that jet, that gas plume, which you could look at with tangential laser light, could travel up to 95, 97 inches. You put a just plain old bandana over that, it dropped that down to about 42 inches. A folded handkerchief brought it down to about 15 inches. A medical mask brought it down to about 8 inches. Actually, stitched quilted cotton, like they showed here, dropped that cough jet, that gas plume, from traveling only a couple of inches. Now, some of that gas would escape out the top and the sides a little bit, but it really just did not have any forward trajectory. Another kind of little clever, simple experiment that was done by this microbiologist at in Providence, Rhode Island, is where he, took petri dishes and he coughed, talked, sang, and sneezed about a couple feet or a little over a foot distance from the petri dish. And of course, the respiratory droplets that fell on those petri dishes grew, you know, a gross amount of bacteria with the coughs and the sneezes, especially. And still, even with the talking and the singing, but with a mask on, nothing grew. And he repeated that experiment, doing the same thing, putting the petri dishes at 2 and 4 and 6 feet, and showed that distance without a mask actually works really well for these kind of large to medium-sized droplets, which this is growing bacteria, not viruses, but the viruses travel in the same droplets. And so it's a nice little pictorial of what masks do. A couple of compelling cases that I think are worth you knowing about if you haven't read about these already. One of these was published in the Canadian Medical Journal, which was a gentleman who was from Wuhan early on in the epidemic, started to get sick, had a short flight from Wuhan to Guangzhou, China. And in Guangzhou, he was supposed to board a plane to Toronto with a direct flight over 15 hours to Toronto. He got on the plane despite feeling sick, probably shouldn't have done that, but he did anyway. And flew the 15 hours, having now fevers and coughing the entire time. Sore throat, fevers, cough, felt ill. And in that plane, which I think was an Airbus, there was 350 other passengers, 25 seated in very close proximity to him within 6 feet. Again, coughing the entire time. He gets off. Next day, his wife starts to get sick. They both go and get tested, are both found to be positive for COVID, which launched a public health investigation of all these 350 passengers, particularly the 25 sitting within 6 feet of him. No transmissions, not one. And the caveat here was that he was masked the entire flight. He never removed his mask. This is a very ideal high-risk setting, an enclosed, confined space of air, people seated close by, someone very early in their symptom onset, so at their peak of their infectiousness, and coughing the whole time, and no transmissions. Another, I think, fairly compelling case is the one of the two hairdressers in Missouri. So after Missouri opened up their lockdown, they allowed hairdressers, gyms, tattoo parlors, et cetera, to go back into business. One of these hairdressers started to get sick. Shame on her. She continued to work for 8 days anyway. Her coworker, who worked right next to her, 3 days later started to get sick. Shame on her. She worked 5 days anyway. The second one, feeling sicker, got tested, was positive. That led to the other one getting tested, positive. They worked 5 to 8 days symptomatic from the start of symptoms on through, exposing 139 clients. This led to a public health investigation where they followed up these 139 clients and got 67 of them to agree to testing. No transmissions. Caveat here again, both were masked the entire time, the hairdresser and the client, with visits ranging from a minimum of 15 minutes to 45 minutes. So this is face-to-face, up close, a foot away, cutting hair, coloring hair. Again, confined space, indoor. You couldn't ask for a more ideal transmission setting, and no transmissions. And then finally, maybe a little bit of data suggesting that masks may protect us, may protect the wearer. This was an anecdote published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, where they noted a middle-aged man was admitted for a community-acquired pneumonia on hospital day 2. He developed acute respiratory failure. They ended up having to do emergent ICU transfer and attempted intubation. It was a difficult intubation. They couldn't get a secure an airway. They were bagging him, several failed intubation attempts. They called extra members of the team from anesthesia, who brought in a video laryngoscope, finally got him intubated, I had to use an airway bougie to help protect his airway. The next morning he was tested and found to be COVID positive. They went and looked back. That very high risk exposure, this is considered aerosolizing procedure, right? It's considered the highest risk kind of that we have in the healthcare setting. 41 healthcare workers were exposed, 85% of whom only wore a surgical mask. So 15% had N95s, but the majority only had a plain medical / surgical mask, no transmissions. So again, a very, very high risk setting here, and no transmissions. Now, we can't say for certain that it's a mask, but it's I think these are add up to sort of compelling stories. And then there's also what we call ecologic data. I'm not going to go into these, but cases in Germany here where widespread masking mandate, no other significant measures at that time brought down cases. Mass General instituting universal masking for the healthcare workers with rising rates until then, flattening and then diminishing after they also added universal masking of patients. Noted marked heterogeneity or disparities in New York during the epidemic. You know, it was the epicenter for the US, where certain boroughs that had heavy Asian population that really adopted masking despite what everybody else was not doing in New York. And those boroughs in Queens and area of Manhattan had much, much lower rates of COVID. Now, that's can't say that's for sure from the masking, but it was noted by a number of the public health people there that they wondered if that was part of it. And just another word or two about treatment and vaccines, and the treatment, again, kind of getting at America's frontline doctors who spent a good chunk of their time promoting hydroxychloroquine. You may have seen some of the stuff on news channels and stuff saying, why aren't we giving the hydroxychloroquine? What's the matter? You know, why are public health trying to suppress this? So I actually found myself in the odd position yesterday, even with some colleagues, having to defend how randomized controlled trials are better than like case series and anecdotes. And it sort of boggled my mind that I was having to defend that. But this is, you know, what we teach in basic epidemiology and epidemiologic study design, that things like case reports, case series, what we call ecologic studies, where you look at, you know, trends in population and trends in, you know, two different trends, you're not looking at actual individuals. Cross-sectional studies, these all are what we call hypothesis generating studies. They don't answer the question about causality. They raise the question like, are we finding a signal here? You get a little bit better with case control studies and cohort studies, but the gold standard is randomized controlled trials. We now have 8 of these for hydroxychloroquine. 2 that we're looking at prophylaxis in high-risk contacts, 1 that's double blind, 1 that's open label. large study here in Spain, 2,300 subjects. It's a preprint, but this is a well-known, high-quality research group that's published on similar stuff in very reputable journals, so I expect this to be published. 2 studies in outpatients with mild to moderate disease, looking at endpoints of time to recovery, hospitalization, no difference, no benefit, no help. And 4 studies in hospitalized patients with moderate to severe disease. 3 of these double blind, 1 of them open label, but randomized trials, all showing no benefit. 3 of these were big public health sponsored trials. The UK recovery trial, which is the UK's big national health plan, where they've got a gigantic study going of multiple different treatment arms. NIH had a smaller study, and the WHO had a very large study. They actually had their interim safety data board unblind the data at various steps along the way. And at one of the later steps, they found there was just no chance of any benefit, only chance of, you know, potential downside or harm. So they stopped those trials early. So I mean, there's ongoing studies and maybe something will change, but right now it just doesn't look very good for hydroxychloroquine. I wish it did. I was encouraging Sanford Health and I was encouraging the state to procure as much of it as possible early on when we had those early observational studies suggesting this, but it is just not bearing out. And then just a couple words about vaccines. If you kind of are interested in following this, the New York Times has a really nice interactive website called their coronavirus vaccine tracker. You can just Google New York Times vaccine tracker. they're following all these different vaccines. There are over 140 in preclinical trials, 18 in phase 1, 12 in phase 2. This is as of today, and it just changes like literally every day. 12 in phase two, 6 trials now in phase three, 1 actually approved in China. And what they did is they basically approved this right after phase two for soldiers. So that's not the way we like to do things, but they wanted to give it to their military because they thought they had enough data with the phase two studies. The 6 that are in phase three are these. AstraZeneca and Oxford have a partnership for a live vaccine. That's an adenovirus backbone into which is a genetically spliced the gene to make the spike protein. Moderna is the RNA vaccine that you might have heard about. There are no licensed RNA or DNA vaccines yet in humans, for humans. I'm not even sure if there are for animals. But this has got a pretty good bet of crossing the finish line. Pfizer's got one that's moving into phase three in partnership with a couple of other companies. And a couple of Chinese companies have killed a whole virus vaccines that seem to be showing promise. And then oddly, BCG is seeking approval. An institute is seeking to get approval for the BCG, which is it's not an antivirus per se, but it stimulates a cell-mediated immune response that basically makes interferon. You kind of ratchet up your interferon levels, which has broad antiviral activity. So these are all moving into phase three. I think the one that's the most likely to cross the finish line first is AstraZeneca partnership with Oxford. This is one of, I believe, 5 that our federal government has heavily invested in to make them Warp Speed. Probably not the best name because it's freaking people out thinking we're cutting corners, but the Warp Speed isn't cutting corners. It's basically just taking the risk away from the vaccine makers to say, we'll pay for production as you go through the 3 phases of trials. Again, this is an adenovirus vector with genetically modified to express the spike protein. It has, it and several others have good antibody and now T cell responses. And we're getting greater understanding that natural infection, you may have read some stuff about antibody levels disappearing by 8 weeks and lots of people don't make very good antibody levels. And that's a mixed bag out there. Some studies showing that we have them last, some saying that they do fade away. But now several studies showing actually pretty good T cell responses, which is a more important thing for memory and durability. So I'm more and more confident that we are making good immune responses to the virus, and vaccines are mimicking that same response. So most of the vaccine candidates so far are looking good that way. This vaccine was shown to completely protect rhesus monkeys from a heavy viral challenge. They are ramping up to have a manufacturing capability of 2 billion doses. And there's the most wildly optimistic projections are that this may be available as early as October. I think that's probably too optimistic. I would look to sometime in the first half of next year. But I suspect this will be the first to cross the finish line. And since the U.S. federal government has invested heavily in this one, even though it's from the U.K., I suspect we will have access to a good number of these. Just a couple words on the back-to-school question. I thank God I'm not pulled in on any committees trying to figure out how to do back-to-school. I've managed to avoid that, and I really want to continue to do so. But I will just briefly address some of the science on this, just some of the risks to kind of consider. If you sort of contrast this with influenza, for example, this is number of deaths from COVID-19 and influenza in U.S. children from February through about a week ago. And you can see influenza has killed more children than COVID has. And if they would kind of make this an even more fair comparison and go back another month or two to capture the December, January cases of influenza, because, influenza went away pretty much in April. COVID didn't. If you were to kind of have a little more apples to apples there, this contrast would even be more. This contrast fades away quickly as you get out of the 5 to 14 year old age group and starts to even out, past 15, and COVID markedly surpasses influenza in other age groups. When you look at some of the data on children, I highly encourage you to download this Harvard Mass General Resource Library on going back to school. Really, really excellent resource. It covers kind of every sort of area of question and gives the science that's out there on this. I'm just summarizing a few of the points here. One, young children express less ACE2, the receptor that allows SARS-CoV-2 to enter the cell. Severe disease in children, extremely rare. Multiple studies showing children are a rare source for household spread. So when you kind of do these contact tracing and looking at it, you know, sources in the house, kids are maybe account for 5 to 10% of secondary cases. So the vast majority of secondary attack rates are not from children. European countries that opened up schools found no increases in cases after they opened up. They did not see clusters or outbreaks or problems. Also several reported cases of ill, these are anecdotal cases, but again, compelling. Several cases of an ill child, you know, found later to be positive, attending school with multiple identified contacts and no transmissions. Those are kind of noteworthy, give a little bit of optimism. However, I would just say warning. First of all, you know, we've heard some about the multiple inflammatory syndrome in children. Now this is only at, you know, it's pretty rare, 342 cases, 6 deaths. Most of the kids recover. It's, you know, obviously more out in the east where the epidemic hit worst, but as it progresses, we'll see it more in the other states, I'm sure. Interestingly, this has a marked racial predilection, much heavier predilection in Hispanic or Latino and non-Hispanic Blacks, less so in Asian and American Indian, interestingly. That needs to be teased out a bit further if, you know, what's behind that, or is that just that the attack rate is higher in those populations, so they're just more exposed. When you look at the syndrome of this by age group, you can see heavy dermatologic and mucocutaneous in the very young, and then kind of moves more towards the gastrointestinal and cardiac as you get into the older age groups. This is kind of a Kawasaki's-like syndrome that can make kids pretty sick. And I haven't taken care of it. I don't know. Maybe Joan, you've seen some or might be able to comment, but this is something to watch for, but it is not it is not common, thankfully. Now, other word of caution is that when you actually don't just rely on who got sick around the kid, but you test, like, test around the kids. This was testing 343 household contacts of the first 229 cases in New York. So this is where they actually tested everybody, not just like who got sick. And, you know, 20% of the kids 0 to 5 were positive. 28% of the 5 to 18 positive. Biggest positivity rates were in the older groups. But, you know, this is not something to sneeze at here. When you look at young children as to how much virus do they shed, or at least what's their viral load by PCR, think of this in the inverse. So SARS-CoV-2 cycle threshold means how many times do you have to run it through the machine to amplify the RNA to get a signal? The lower the number here, the more the RNA. So actually the under 5-year-old group had more RNA, had a lower cycle threshold or more RNA in their secretions than did the older age groups. So they looks like they may, when you do test them for it, they shed a lot of virus. So I just, the word of caution is that we have to understand we have some limitations on what we know. Very low rates of symptomatic infection limit most of these studies. If you're looking for like who gets sick, kids don't get sick. So if you're using that as your criteria for how much spread there were, you're missing a lot, I think. Children may be missed as an index case as they're less often tested. Secondary attack rates relying on symptoms may miss many household infections. And child-to-child transmission may be missed in schools if they're relying on syndromic surveillance. About all these European countries that, like, you know, we opened up our schools and we did great. Well, they did that when they really had things under good control. I mean, they were not surging in their communities. They were in a pretty good situation. And I'd like to see that happen when things are heating up and see if it changes things or not. So I'm going to stop there and kind of leave it to questions for Joanne and I.
All right, I'll open it up for questions. Thanks a lot, Dr. Carson. As usual, very excellent, excellent discussion. Joan, did he answer your question that you had at the beginning?
Actually, I don't think I did I, Joan? What was your question?
I'm trying to think of what it was again. I don't know, but I'm really stuck on that ACE2 receptor. That's really cool. I knew. So that's kind of like the same thing as why kids less than 3 tend not to get strep, because they don't have the receptor, right?
Yeah, NC diff. NC diff.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
So are there any drugs in the pipeline that are targeting?
There are a number of drugs in the pipeline, and what is it, Fapazipravir or something like that is kind of making its way into later phase trials. I'm butchering that name. That's not an antiviral I've heard of before. There are other release drugs that are being looked at. I haven't heard promise of anything, you know, like any of them looking particularly promising. The remdesivir I didn't show. They took that trial where they showed earlier recovery in remdesivir a little bit further, and it is looking like it's also translating into a mortality benefit as well. That trial is yet, the full results of that trial is yet to be published, but that's looking better. It's not a knock it out of the ballpark, savior drug, but with dexamethasone and, you know, earlier intervention, I think the impression of a lot of clinicians taking care of this is that they're seeing better success.
I guess we had the question was about, you were going to talk more about sports, return to sports.
That was not the question, but I will. Okay.
That was one question.
But it is a fair question. Yeah. That's a fair question.
Oh, no, it was the, okay. So the CDC guidance where you can come back to school when your fever is down for 24 hours.
That was it. Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I don't know. So when you look at, this was adults, when you look at adults who had the virus and you culture them like daily, culturable virus is a surrogate for transmissible virus. They shed virus out to day 8 to 10, culturable virus out to day 8 to 10. And, you know, I don't know how many of them were resolving their fever, but I think a number of them were. I mean, fever sometimes doesn't last really long. I think we would need to see better studies to be comfortable about that. I like the 10-day criteria and at least a day without fever. I think, like, you know, a kid who's hardly symptomatic at all and doesn't have fever and, well, they can go right back 2 days after they're tested or a day after they're tested, I think you're asking for potential trouble. But And sports, Misty. So here's my opinion on sports. If it isn't outside and something that's spread apart, I think it's going to be doomed. I'm sorry if you got kids in volleyball or hockey or something, but it's interesting to me, you know, at NDSU, the athletes returned on campus in kind of, I think, early July. Their coaches were all over them about being careful and not mixing with, you know, other kids out there, being, you know, being really judicious. It took them less than 2 weeks to have a major outbreak amongst the athletes. Same thing at UND. Now that's maybe a little different. They also were living with each other in, you know, apartments and that sort of thing. So that's different from high school and middle school. But I think indoor activity where people are working hard, breathing hard, shouting, you know, jumping around, working out, I think is going to be problematic. It's very difficult.
It's okay. My daughter wants to play football, so.
I am asking,
you know, just, I mean, yeah. We get a lot of questions about that too. And
yeah, you see the college football teams and, professional football, they're all struggling to figure out how to do this. I think my personal opinion is there's going to be a couple clusters of outbreaks and the dominoes are going to fall and they're going to end up, you know, I hope that's not the case, but I just can't see how that there won't be. There already have been on several of the several other colleges have had outbreaks in their athletes just starting up, and also in some of the professional teams. I just can't see how it's not going to happen. And then you get, you know, one or two or three, your star players knocked out, or a team that has to cancel and they're in quarantine, and there goes the conference. So I just think that'll be really good. I think soccer actually pretty good. Tennis pretty good. Maybe even swimming. I'd have to think about that one a little bit. That's inside, obviously, but it's pretty big volume there. The water is probably safe. I don't know. I'd have to think about that because they are breathing pretty heavy kind of in lanes right next to each other. I don't know. But outdoor and spread apart, I think, is pretty good. I don't know how many field hockey teams there are out there. Probably not too many. But
Dr. Burr, you had a question.
Yes. Is there going to be a good way to measure our T cell response? That's what a TB skin test is, isn't it?
A TB skin test is a measure of cell-mediated immunity. The main way these are done is very similar to the counterpart to the TB skin test, which are what are called IGRAs, interferon gamma release assays. So you basically take people's whole blood, you spin off the buffy coat or the white cells, and then you throw in some antigen in there and you see if those cells get turned on by, you know, do they get turned on and do they make interferon or do they make some other cytokine? I did these in my fellowship. These are cumbersome, not easy to do tests. They're not cheap. I think research labs will be doing this as part of, you know, the research. I think a commercial assay to do this is, I haven't seen anybody stepping up to that yet. I suspect somebody will, but I'll bet that's many months away.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mateo asks whether trained dogs will be helpful in detecting cases in school.
So he's, I don't know if he's half kidding or half serious, but you know, the trained dog, like they've shown like some of the really good smelling dog, like beagles and stuff, they can smell like C. diff really well. Like they're like as good as like many of our assays. And I think that's been found to be true of other diseases. Dr. Mateo probably knows better than me. I have not heard of that for SARS-CoV-2, but I would love to see him launch a trial.
Dr. Mateo, I have some Basset hounds that I would love to bring to work with me. So if you want to train them, I'm happy to run with it. Can I ask a question to Dr. Carson? Do you have any concerns about the volume of influenza vaccine that's going to be able to be produced with all of these labs diverting their resources?
That's a good question. I haven't heard that question yet. I think, you know, the production facilities for the way influenza vaccine is produced, which is, you know, this archaic way of growing it in chicken eggs, it's not the way that any of the current vaccines that I'm aware of are being looked at being produced for SARS-CoV-2. So I don't think those production facilities are being hijacked for SARS-CoV-2. I don't know that for certain, but my guess on that would be that won't be an issue. I do wonder, though, if demand for influenza vaccine will go up. I've seen there's now a handful of universities. Purdue is one, maybe Jacksonville, University of Florida, Jacksonville. I think there's a handful of these that are mandating it for their college kids, like we do in healthcare. That, you know, they're talking about mandating a flu vaccine to come on campus, and that could drive up demand. There may be other countries, other places, other, you know, programs to, because a lot of people are going to want to not be contending with influenza on top of this. So I suspect demand may be higher, and that has stretched us in the past. I mean, supply sometimes gets to be problematic because of demand issues.
Dr. Luke asks that, or states, I guess, I find it disturbing that you have to defend the value of double-blind studies to our colleagues. What is causing this, and what can be done to address it?
I don't know what's causing it for sure. So I think a couple things are behind it. I think one is there's some desperation for having treatment options. And so, you know, people want to believe that, you know, these things may help or may work. I worry a little bit that, you know, when our president came out so strongly in favor of hydroxychloroquine, that a lot of people looked at any trials that showed lack of benefit or harm. And to be fair, there was a big harm trial out there that turned out to be pretty bogus. And so I think there was concern that bogus studies like that had to be retracted, and was that politically motivated to damage the president, or what about these other studies? Are they doing that to? I think that's what's behind some of this, is concerns that, you know, are there political motivations to say the opposite of what he said? My answer to that is I just can't imagine. First of all, I've done a lot of clinical trials. Most of us can't get our, you know, crap together well enough to like conspire against anything. You know, I to have the World Health Organization conspire and the UK, you know, National Health System conspire on their trials. I think that's improbable. Now it's a trial. They're all showing the same thing consistently. I'm hoping that the little bit of defending I had to do to colleagues on, I've had to do it a bunch with sort of the lay public, but I think the dialogue recently with colleagues was more in line. So here's the other thing that was driving it. I don't know if you saw this, but a Yale epidemiologist named Dr. Harvey Risch, who's got pretty impeccable credentials as a cancer epidemiologist, published an article in the American Journal of Epidemiology, prestigious journal, looking at five of these non-randomized trials, saying, look, there's a strong signal of benefit here, and we're not paying attention to this, and particularly in combination with azithromycin, there's something here. And he came out very strong on national TV advocating this. I think some of my colleagues say, I think we should listen to this, but my answer to that is like, we've got the next best, we've got the better studies. And there's actually several in the pipeline still. There is an azithromycin hydroxychloroquine combination randomized blinded placebo-controlled trial. That'll answer that question. But I don't feel compelled to use the drug unless something shows a better signal there.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Kumar, you had a question.
I had one comment about the ACE2 receptor expression. Actually, that is only in less than 10 years. So it does not tell us anything about the middle school and high school students who would continue to be like affected by this. And the second one is a shameless plug. I'm moderating an international session on MISC and school reopening, in which Chief Scientific Officer of WHO will be joining, and people from India, UK, and different parts of US. I'll forward the link to Courtney, and we'd love to have you guys there. Thank you.
Great. Very good. And you're absolutely right. You know, that's for young children that expression is lower. And you know, when you get above about 14, the kids really don't look much different with the infection rates and that sort of thing than adults. So I actually think, elementary school, we're probably going to be okay, I think, if I had to bet. But I think middle school and high school, I think we're going to see clusters of outbreak. We'll see it. And there's going to be the issues of, you know, how do you keep the teachers safe and the staff that, you know, may have underlying health conditions and so on. I'm not that worried about the kids, even the middle school and high school kids. I think, you know, they're bearing about the same risk they bear with influenza or other things. And we accept that, and they don't get their flu shots. I mean, so like they can do something to prevent that risk. I keep it in perspective, but I think we'll see, I have a concern we'll see clusters in middle school and high school, and then that'll be, how do you keep teachers and staff safe?
And what you very elegantly described, I sent the slide to Courtney and to Joan. It like walks us through the brisk IL-6 and interferon IFN response. And the viral load seems to be, if it is low and there is a high IFN interferon response, the disease is mild and they do well. And this is the biggest problem I think we are having. We are unable to quantify the viral load. Even in the doubling time is one way, but still we are struggling to predict who are the student, children or the adults who would be having an adverse outcome. So we are just, I think, looking into that, you know, early interferon response, rapid viral clearing, less inflammation, mild disease. So I hope they have an IFN assay commercially.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I think I hope we'll see more research come out on what are clinical or genetic markers that predict bad outcome, because this is like lightning striking in some people. When we already see type A blood type does worse than type O blood type. You know, why is that? Probably some other gene that runs in the same, you know, cluster there. But I think hopefully we'll get more sophisticated at finding what genetic predispositions lead to people being more likely to do poorly.
Thanks, Dr. Kumar, for raising that. Dr. Dwelly, you had your hand raised.
Yeah, Paul, could we use a booster antibody response as a harbinger for T cell memory?
I wish I was a better immunologist to be able to answer that question, but I would say, you know, Terry, I would guess that to be probable, because in those studies that looked at T cell, actually they looked at, you know, a comprehensive battery of immune responses, and both antibodies to spike proteins and neutralizing antibodies correlated very well with the T cell response. So, you know, the higher those levels, the better the T cell response and so on. But T cell response was there even in the poorer responders. But yeah, I think that's, you know, it's measuring two different things. I mean, it's measuring, you know, memory B cells. I guess I just don't know. I don't know enough immunology to answer that. But that would be a nice, easy way of, if that works, that would be a much easier way of assessing immune response than trying to get an interferon gamma release assay out there and commercially available.
All right, Dr. Haugen has a couple of questions. His first question is, what is the current false positive rates for our current testing?
So I think a more important question is the false negative rate, but let me address the false positive. So false positive for PCR tests, we think is like extraordinarily low. The only reason for a false positive is like a contaminated sample or, you know, some kind of mix up in the lab or sampling error. You just really shouldn't find RNA, and these PCR assays are so specific for that particular genetic marker that they just don't cross-react with other viruses. I think the false negative rate, now this is PCR we're talking about, which is, you know, detecting viral infection. I think the false negative rate is a more interesting, difficult question. You know, everybody has a presumption that, oh, you know, RNA amplification, PCR, that's great. That finds everybody. It doesn't. There are just scads and scads of examples of people who, for whatever reason, got tested one day and got tested, you know, positive, and for whatever reason got tested the next day and is negative. And there was one study that was done where they actually took hospitalized patients, you know, right at the onset of their hospitalization and collected multiple specimens over 2 days. Sputum, saliva, throat, nose, BAL fluid. And they knew they were positive. They're sick in the hospital. And it was almost like half the samples were negative. It varied somewhat on where you collect. In China, you know, when they had their outbreak roaring, found, like, you know, we're in the midst of the height of the epidemic, and we got people coming in who were exposed and were our contacts and are sick with a viral-like illness and ground glass infiltrates on their chest x-ray or CT scan, and they test negative. And they're like, I think it's COVID. And so they changed their definition to include ground glass infiltrates on a CT scan because they believed they were missing a pretty good chunk of people. So I get a little nervous about ruling somebody out, especially a symptomatic person, ruling somebody out with a single test. And I just think we need more data on this, and we need to kind of, you know, wonder, you know, look further into, like, you know, more than one sample or sampling again. But to the specific question about false positivity with the PCR, I think extraordinarily rare. Sensitivity is a bigger question. Now for antibody testing, it's kind of all over the board. You can find specificity ranging from, you know, on most of the antibody tests, if you're going to say test them at least 3 to 4 weeks after their infection to see about an antibody response, 90 to 99.8%, depending on the assay. We're doing a study right now from the L&M wind turbine factory outbreak, validating sensitivity on some of those tests and hopefully specificity. But so you realize if you got even a 2% false positive rate in a very low prevalence population, so if we're only sitting at 5% of the population having been infected, most of your positives are going to be false. The positive predictive value is very poor then. You need a 99.9% specific test. I think we're actually getting higher prevalence than that now. 1%, almost 1% of North Dakotans have tested positive by PCR. And other studies have suggested that for every one PCR positive test you get, you probably have somewhere between 5 to 10 other people out there that were infected and you didn't know it. So we might have, 10% of our population already infected or more. We just got some preliminary data back on testing a whole bunch of pharmacists in Cass and Grand Forks County, 15% positive by antibodies. We're going to try and validate that with a better test, but we don't know how many of those are false. Anyway, that's more than you probably wanted, Joel. Or I don't know which Dr. Haugen it is. I don't know if it's Joel.
It was Joel. He also, thanks, Dr. Carson. Dr. Haugen also asked, some COVID patients experience long-term symptoms. How frequently does this occur?
Yeah, I was afraid somebody was going to catch me on that. I've been meaning to look into that. What are the reports on long-term outcomes? I just saw one study that was published recently that kind of had a provocative headline, and the news picked it up, lots of people suffer long-term effects. Well, it was 3 weeks out. People were still tired and achy. I have not, the question I think you're getting is more serious long-term outcomes. I apologize. I don't know that.
For a future webinar, maybe. Dr. Dwelly, you had another question?
Yeah, Paul, which serology test are you using in that study? I'm just interested.
So there was four antibody tests done. So the kind of gold standard one was the Abbott Architect, which you have to draw the blood, and that was done in your former lab, still our lab at State Health Department. And then three different point of care antibody tests, finger prick, but we did it on the drawn blood, but they are made and marketed as point of care tests. Actually, they all look like they perform pretty well as far as sensitivity goes. It looked to me, it would be maybe a 2% false negative. I have to do the math on that, but they all look pretty good.
Have you used the Roche test yet?
For antibodies?
Yeah.
No, we don't have that. I think that's what Mayo has, maybe. We don't have that. We have the Abbott and we have the Diasorin, both of which their package inserts report 99.9% specificity. They're both saying that they're both qualitative assays, not quantitative. And sensitivity is not maybe not that, sensitivity is more like, I think, in the range of 95%, but specificity on both of those is looking pretty good.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Dwelly, and Dr. Carson and Dr. Connell. This has been a great webinar. I think we'll wrap it up right now and really appreciate you spending your time tonight listening, asking questions, supporting NDMA, and hope everyone has a good evening and we'll see you August 19th.
All right, bye guys. Thank you, bye-bye.
Thank you. End meeting.